My name is Linda. I'm an alcoholic. May I have a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. As I said, my name is Linda. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm currently serving as the Panel 60 delegate to the conference from Mid-Southern California area, Area 9, and my home group is the Noontime Recovery in Costa Mesa, California, at the corner of 19th and Harbor. It conveniently meets at noon, Monday through Friday, and we'd love to have you come and visit us. We have lots of room. Not this much, but we have a lot of room. I do want to, for the recording, I do want to say that I'm very happy to see that all 6,600 seats are filled. Now, why are they laughing? I'm just going to start with a little bit of an introduction about the topic. In all our affairs, when someone heard that I was going to be chairing this meeting, they said, well, that's appropriate for you, Linda. Probably for many of us. It's interesting to me how often and how well some of our phrases translate into other things. You know, I always thought that a love and service would be a good sign outside a brothel. But it works well for us, too. But I think what we're probably going to talk about, I hope they're not all going to talk about their extramarital affairs, but but I think what we're talking about is the principles, practicing the principles in all our affairs. And one of the things I just wanted to share with you is that one of my favorite concepts is concept 10, where it talks about equal responsibility with equal authority. And years ago, when Jim and I first got sober, my husband has 5 days more sobriety than I do. Yay, Jim. And my sobriety date is February 1st, 1980. Thank you. And very near the early part of our sobriety, because we were putting our marriage back together, we somehow came up with the idea that we had two cars. One was his, one was mine. And when we were driving our own car, the other person had to be quiet. Equal responsibility and equal authority. We respected the other person's responsibility for driving and the authority to make decisions. Now, that meant that both of us probably had holes in our tongue for about 10 years. But we couldn't tell each other where to go or when to stop or which direction to go or how to get anywhere. And it was a wonderful opportunity to practice the principles in at least one of our affairs, which was driving. So now I'm going to introduce the first speaker for today, whose name is Brian. And I just met Brian about 10 minutes ago, and I think he's fantastic, and I'm sure you'll enjoy him as much as I have.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic. Let's move that a little closer. Wow, I've been sober since February 17th, 1997. I'm really grateful for that. I do have a home group. It's the St. Louis Park Sunday Night AA Group, also known as Slipsnag, and it conveniently meets in St. Louis Park, Minnesota on Sunday nights. And I'd like to invite you all to join us if you're ever in Minnesota. Woohoo! I have no idea what I'm going to talk about, really. I did the third step prayer behind these curtains a few minutes ago and remembered that this isn't the Brian show, that this is about telling you guys what God has done in my life and how I found the miracle of recovery. I grew up very uncomfortable, very consumed with self. I was just filled with self-centered fear, always have been. It was a very heavy cloak on me, I would say. And I got a late start on my drinking. I didn't really start drinking until I was 20 years old, and that's a long time to go with that kind of self-awareness. And the one escape I did have was through music. I didn't realize at that time that that was a connection with a power greater than myself. But it, for me, it was the one way that I could escape from life. And life always seemed really tragic, and I don't know why that was. Having grown up in a nice middle-class family, it seemed very tragic to me. I had a couple of experiences with alcohol in my teens. One time where I didn't get enough to feel the effect of alcohol. And then one time where I learned how to drink, where I filled up the biggest glass I could, as high as I could with alcohol, put as little mixer in as possible, and drank it as fast as I could. And I went right past the happy feeling into blackout drunk, and I told myself, well, that's silly. I'm not going to do that again. And I didn't do that again for a couple more years. But when I was in college, I found that I discovered what it could do for me. And I had a few drinks, and the warmth spread through my body. And all of a sudden, all the gears clicked into place. Everything felt right. And I knew I was in the right place at the right time. And it was the first time I'd ever had that feeling. And looking back, if I had known that alcohol could do that for me, I would have been drinking in kindergarten without a doubt. Because I needed a drink bad. And I chased that every chance I got. I would say my drinking kind of progressed quickly. I only drank for 7 or 8 years. The first couple years were just all about that warm, happy, free feeling. And it was, I just thought that was the greatest thing ever. A little ways into my drinking, I discovered the magic of I could drink at things. So I had a couple of bad things happen to me, and my first thought was to turn to alcohol. I sort of took to drinking naturally, right? It came pretty naturally to me. So I knew, even though I had never done that before, I knew that if that I was feeling bad and that I could take a drink and it was going to make everything else go away. And so that was a great discovery. And it was great to be able to drink at things and celebrate over things. So, you know, Monday through Friday, Saturday, Sunday, morning, night, there's always a reason to drink at something or to celebrate something. And that is not going to end well. The third phase, I would say, of my drinking was that I had moved to San Francisco, and I grew up in Minnesota. I had moved to San Francisco, and my life had centered around the bar, and I was drinking pretty heavily in this stretch. And there was one particular night in January, and it was raining, and it was chilly, and I was on the last bus home of the night. I was still wearing my suit from work because I thought I was very fancy, and I was very, very drunk. And I got off the Muni car, and I was walking home, and I threw up in the middle of the street. I made it, you know, I continued to walk home another block or so. I peed my pants, which was very glamorous. And then a little bit later, just before I got home, I soiled myself, and still wearing my suit from work, which was really great. And I told myself, gosh, you should cool it for a while. If I just, and I think, you know, if I just don't drink for 30 days, I can prove to myself that I'm not an alcoholic. And I got, and so I stopped drinking. I didn't change any behavior. I didn't go to any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to the bar every night, and I just drank water. And at about 25 or 27 days into my 30 days, my head made that switch and just started talking to me and saying, well, you've proved your point already. You've already gone, you know, 25 days or 27 days or whatever it is. You've already proven you're not alcoholic, so why not just start drinking again? And as quickly as that thought came into my head, I started drinking again. And this enters my phase of quitting and managing my drinking and, you know, trying to make bargains with my drinking and all that stuff. And this started the rather quick downhill slide, I would say. I had moved back to Minnesota. I realized that my problem was that I didn't have enough money to afford how I wanted to drink. So I went to graduate school, and I got an MBA, and which was the great thing about that is I went to class from 8 until noon every morning, and then at noon I would take my books and my laptop to the bar and I would write my papers in the bar and do all my studying in the bar. It was just a great, it was a great setup for me. But things just kept getting worse, and my behavior just kept getting worse, really. I had a problem where it seemed like every time I drank, my pants fell down. So I had a lot of problems keeping my clothes on. And I was a bar drinker, because I knew the alcoholics drank at home alone, so I drank in the bar. And you can't be without your clothes at the bar. And I had a little... So the authorities got involved just a little bit. And the judge suggested that I should talk to somebody about my problem. And I started seeing a therapist. And I didn't want to talk about my drinking. I didn't think that had anything to do with what was going on in my life. By this time, I'm, you know, just full alcoholic. My thinking has completely changed and warped so that everything in my head revolves around drinking. I had I was having some serious money problems because I spent way more than I made. And I one day I was walking home from work, and I walked past this truck. And in the bed of the truck, there was a big scary-looking dog in there. And my first thought was, if I could get this dog to maul me just a little bit, right, just hurt me a little bit, I could probably sue the owner of that truck, and I could pay off my debts, and I could get ahead a little bit. So that's what my thinking is like at this stage of my drinking. And so I'm seeing this therapist, and we're talking about my problems, and he diagnosed me with an anxiety disorder, which I was greatly relieved to hear that that's what was wrong with me. And I thought, you've pinpointed it exactly. And we didn't talk about my drinking for a while. But eventually we needed to. It was bad. My world just got smaller and smaller and smaller. I couldn't go to work. I couldn't pay my bills. I avoided my family like the plague. I dropped friends. I was seeking out lower companions. I think others were seeking out me. It was just, I was really getting depressed. So my therapist had started this exercise where he told me to drink two drinks and then stop drinking and switch to water or something non-alcoholic. And I would try that experiment, and I would come back the next week and say, well, that didn't quite work. And he'd say, well, try drinking just one drink and then stopping. He was leading me to my discovery that I was alcoholic. That thought had not crossed my mind, really. And in December of 1996, I started my last run, and it was on Christmas. I tried to spend as little time as possible with my family, as it was just too much. So I did my family obligations, and then I went down to the bar. And I met up with some people, and I was just off and running. And I don't know how many days it was, but I was just out drinking. I was not feeling good. It was not a good time in my life, and I was starting to see that I really, you know, was going to have to stop drinking. But I couldn't imagine that being possible. Around that time, my dad, who had gotten sober when I started drinking, came over to my house out of the blue and was telling me about a friend of his in AA who had just committed suicide. He told me that no matter how bad things get, there's always a place you can go for help. And he honestly didn't know what was going on with me at the time, and I couldn't figure out why he was telling me that. But about 3 weeks later, I found myself wanting to die. The 3 weeks in between were like desperately trying not to drink and then drinking with desperation in between. And it was just miserable. My last night of drinking, I think, pretty typical. I was attacked by a Hmong gang in my car in a random neighborhood in St. Paul, Minnesota. And as these kids were, like, kicking my car and beating on my car, I had this weird moment where I actually kind of stepped out of myself and said, how did a nice boy from the suburbs get here? You know, how did I get to this place? And, like, this absolutely cannot be the life that I'm living. Like, I don't know how I got there. And I managed to get out of that situation unharmed. I decided I was going to kill myself. I went home. I did not kill myself. And the next morning, I had called my therapist that I was still seeing and said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, duh. And the next thing I know, I was on my voyage of sobriety. And that was, you know, February 17th, 1997. And we found some AA meetings to go to. I also went to an outpatient treatment program. I had a wide-open social calendar at that point. I wasn't getting a lot of invitations to places. And so I started going to meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous. And my first meeting, I saw my bartender at the meeting, and I was greatly relieved by that. I thought that was so comforting to me. And he told me about another meeting a couple days later, and I went to that meeting. And someone at that meeting told me, she asked where I lived. I said, I live in Minnesota, in St. Louis Park. And she said, oh, there's a really great meeting just a few blocks from your house. And that Sunday night, when I had 6 days of sobriety, I walked into Slip Snag. And I knew that I was home. I had that moment where all the stars aligned. I was ready to get sober, and they were ready to receive me. And I walked away from that meeting with hope, because I knew I was going to not drink in between that meeting time and the next time I went back there. I knew I was going to ask somebody to be my sponsor. And that was enough, right? That was absolutely enough. You know, there's a bunch of guys sitting right over there that were at that first meeting that I was at, and they've known me my entire sobriety. I think that's awesome. So I went back that next week, and I made a very studied examination of who should be my sponsor by asking the first person who said hello to me. It turns out the people that come up to you and say hello to you in the meetings are the ones that are active in service and doing 12-step work. My sponsor happened to be our local intergroup office manager, which I regretted immediately. But he and I started working together. We went through the book and worked all 12 steps, and he got me in service right away. I got a job at my home group. I attended regular meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our group had several outside service commitments that I went to. He made me go out for fellowship. I thought that was terrible. And very quickly, my life changed. I went from hopeless to full of hope in a matter of just a couple of months. And I caught fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned, like, at the beginning, I learned such practical things. Like, I could not keep my house stocked with toilet paper and paper towels to save my life when I was drinking. You know, I just couldn't do, like, the most basic of things. And it seemed like going to regular meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous put some structure in my life. And I had someone that I could talk to about things. And he showed me how to go to the store regularly. And he showed me how to balance my checkbook. And he showed me how to live within my means. I had about a year sober. I hit a financial bottom where I bounced a check for an AA speaker tape. It was a $5 tape that ended up costing me like $39 or something like that. And I said, I need to do some inventory work around this. And we did an inventory of it, and I started making financial amends. And because I started making financial amends, I have not bounced the check since that date. Right? I was taught about taking contrary action. You know, because I knew that the steps weren't going to work, but I tried them anyways. You know, I learned about doing things somebody else's way, as my friend Kirk says, and he owes me a dollar now that I said his name. I just learned how to suspend disbelief, right, and just take the next action. And my life opened up. I had the chance to move to San Francisco a couple of years into sobriety. We actually moved just about a month after the International Convention in Minneapolis, which was an amazing experience to be part of the host city. And I can't even describe to you how great that was and the love I felt. And, you know, I definitely feel it here as well. But we moved to San Francisco for a job. And, you know, I learned so much more in San Francisco at about 6 years of sobriety. I have the ability to have mental obsessions on just about everything, and I tend to cycle through a handful of favorites. Money, food, sex, relationships. Those are my four highlights. And I was in one of them, just really struggling, and I kept writing 10-step inventories with my sponsor, and I could not shake this obsession, and I got really desperate. It turned out it wasn't a 10-step issue, it was a first-step issue, a 1-2-3 issue. And I needed a bigger God. I needed a God that was going to be, that was going to solve my problems in all of my areas of life, not just staying sober or not just, you know, this or that. I needed a God in all areas of my life, and I needed a bigger God for that than the one I had. And just at my most desperate point, I was at a meeting, and I must have shown on my face because these two women came up to me before the meeting and said, "Okay, spill it. You have to tell us what's going on." And I got really honest, and I shared what was going on. And the two of them, they wrote on a piece of paper, "You need to call this person." And they wouldn't tell me who she was or what she did, but they said, "She's going to help you." And so I called that name. If I had known who she was, I would not have called her. So just a little background. I'm trained as a CPA, right? I'm a numbers guy. I'm full of logic. I like logic. I like things that make sense. This woman is a rebirther, and I went to see her, and I had a spiritual experience. I swear to God, when I went to see her, and something shifted inside of me. And the next day, that obsession was gone, and it has not come back since. You know, once again, it's that lesson of do it somebody else's way. I don't have the answers. You know, I'm the broken hammer. You can't fix a broken hammer with a broken hammer. And I didn't have the answers, but somebody else did. And they shared that with me freely. I went and my life changed. And shortly after that, I got this sort of nugget of an idea that what I'm doing here in Alcoholics Anonymous it's not about changing who Brian is. It's about discovering the Brian that God created, and being exactly that Brian. So that's been my journey since then, is really about being exactly who I am, perfect as God created me. I've since moved around the country a couple more times and getting ready to do it again. One of God's jokes, I think, for me is that for every international convention, I move to another city within 30 days before or after. And it looks like I'm in Minnesota now, and it looks like in about 30 days, I move into Atlanta, Georgia. So, and when I moved back to Minnesota 2 years ago, I said, "I am never moving again." And I know better. I know better than to say stupid things like that. I don't know where I was. So I've moved around, and one of the things that I keep learning. So there's been a lot of uncertainty in the last year of my life. A lot of things going on, and you know, in my family and my professional life, just a ton of uncertainty. And I realized that I have absolute faith in God in the macro sense, right? I know things are going to work out. What I've really found out about myself is that I still have a lot of moments, day to day, minute to minute, where I'm afraid. And I don't need to be afraid. I have enough experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't need to be afraid of what's going to happen to me. And I've really been watching what that feels like and asking myself, why am I afraid? And so I've been in a lot of prayer this last year. I've worked with three new guys in the last 2 years. That's been absolutely a godsend, because I've been right in the middle of all of the steps, like all of the time, and really watching people's lives change. And that's, you know, if there's a drug that I'm addicted to now, it's watching people recover. It is ridiculous how awesome that is to see the lights go on in people's eyes. But I've been in a lot of prayer, and I'm, you know, I'm coming to this other side now where it's like, I don't need to be afraid minute to minute, day to day. I can have faith in my higher power. Because no matter what area of my life it's been, everything has always worked out perfectly. It may not always be exactly how I had intended, but it's always worked out perfectly. And that's a great, you know, I've gotten a great way of life out of being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. The price of admission is to absolutely ruin every aspect of your life and destroy all the relationships around you. That's a fair trade-off for me, and a couple of bucks a week. I'm really grateful to be sober. Glad you're all here in San Antonio, and hope we all have a great time this weekend. Thank you.
I told them that I'm only here to judge them. I just gave Brian an A+. Now, put a lot of pressure on the other two. A couple of things I want to remind you. One is that there's no photos in the meetings. Please don't take any photos in here. And recordings of this meeting are available at the recording booth in the main hall. Getting back to affairs, a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of people in this room, well, maybe some of the people in this room have had extramarital affairs, possibly. My first husband and I did it a little bit differently. We had an affair with another couple, and we moved together. It was in the 60s. Now, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. But during the 60s, my first husband and I and another couple moved together with our six children and all of our menagerie of pets. And so the 10 of us lived together for 3 years in a sort of upper middle class commune in Newport Beach. And during that time, we switched partners. And it turned out that the two of us who ended up together were alcoholic, and fortunately the other two were not, so it saved them a lot of pain. When we moved apart, we moved apart the other way, but so we switched partners, and we are, Jim and I have been together since January of 1969, and as have the other couple, and we've been married since September 21st, 1973. So Jim and I got drunk together and then got sober together, and I'll tell you, the last 30 years has been a lot better than the 2 years before that. But practicing these principles in all our affairs has included the 14 grandchildren that we have who have never seen us drink, and our relationship with our exes who are still married to each other and are among our very best friends. And practicing these principles in my work and practicing these principles in my neighborhood and in my community, being able to take the principles that I learn in Alcoholics Anonymous recovery meetings and service has been invaluable to me. And it is as if I was a child when I got here and I had to learn everything from scratch. I am so glad that things are as simple as they are in Alcoholics Anonymous, so that I get to learn these principles in a step-by-step way, so to speak. And now I'd like to introduce Lee, who is our second speaker, and another one of my favorite people from the last 15 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Lee. I am a grateful recovering alcoholic, member of Alcoholics Anonymous from Washington, D.C., where I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and a couple of sponsees who have me, and two home groups, three home groups. My first home group was assigned to me, Change of Life group. I still go there. My second is Brightwood. Brightwood in the house? Brightwood's in the house. Where I chair a step meeting, steps and traditions meeting on Tuesdays. And the third meeting that has my heart, the one that has my heart because of the content, not as much because of the fellowship, is As Bill Sees It, which meets in D.C. on Sundays at 10:30. So, you know, if you're ever in Washington, I can promise you one thing, and that is that it works. You know, it works at least at three places I know. Let's see. I have to say I cheated. I knew I wasn't going to be able to stand up and do this cold, so I took a few notes so I could remember my story. The rest of the stuff is easy. Let's see, my name, I said that, right? Okay. As Bill sees it, you know, I love this book. I mean, I love this book. It's like people to me. It's like another person. I never think of it as getting to know Bill Wilson, but I think of it as getting to know what kept Bill Wilson, what got him sober, and what he's passed on to us. Let's see. I'm supposed to share a little bit of experience, strength, and hope. My sponsor's nodding. What happened and how I got here and what's happened since then. Okay. I grew up in D.C. I loved calling D.C. my hometown, but I wasn't born there. However, I was raised with natives. It's hard not to be a native when you're raised with natives. It was the first sense I had that I really didn't belong. My first memories are actually of the clinking in a glass. I was a little girl in the Virgin Islands, and everybody drank all the time, and they were wonderful to me. I was the only kid around, so I have all these wonderful memories of people throwing me up in the air and rocking me, and just, you know, I was the center of attention, which I, of course, no longer like to be. That's a lie. I'm sorry. That's a lie. I'm supposed to keep this honest. So I wanted what all those people had. You know, I wanted the music, the calypso, I wanted the laughter and the pretty clothes and all that nice smells of, you know, cologne and high test, you know, top shelf alcohol. And, you know, it took a while before I could actually drink like they did, but I got there. My first drink, however, was not about wanting good stuff. It was anger. My last drink was also anger. I drank because I was angry with my father, who was a high-functioning alcoholic with a lot of power both in our household and in the greater community. And he was my first higher power, I guess. And all I really wanted to do was please him. So I learned people-pleasing early. And there came a time when I reached adolescence when pleasing Daddy didn't work anymore. And, you know, he'd rather be around guys my age who he was sort of like a father figure to. And then I had this little sister who was adopted when I was 8 who was sort of felt like I was being replaced. And then there was the divinely beautiful mother whom I could never, be like. So I was pretty pissed. And one day I went to a party down the street from me, and the guys were drinking. Girls didn't drink in those days. At least they didn't drink at parties. And I didn't know any girls who drank at all. But the guys would come in and they had something in their, you know, this was in the days when people dressed for parties, so they'd reach into their jackets and they'd pour stuff into one of the punch bowls. There were two. They came from Highs, and they were big blocks of ice. One was green, one was red. They tasted the same otherwise. But after the alcohol went into one of them, the girls knew that's the boys' punch bowl. This particular day, a friend told me, I said, "What's in there?" And he said, "Mooby Fooby." And I thought, okay. And I remembered all these guys that my father was sort of paying more attention to than me, and they would get drunk. And I thought, you know, this is intentional. They're doing this to take his attention away from me. I know that this alcohol thing is all psychosomatic. So I downed about 5 or 6 glasses of Mooby Fooby. And I remember sitting in the middle of the dance floor with all my girlfriends just dancing around me. Oh, they were having a great time. No one even looked down. It was as if I was invisible. Some people helped me up, and they got me out of there. And, you know, a great humiliation and a lot of vomiting and bed spinning and a near rape later. I woke up and heard my father say, "She's just drunk. Don't worry about it," to my mother. I drank over a lot of stuff. From that first drink when I was 16, I didn't drink at all for a long time. The 60s came along, and they saved me from alcohol. The only bottle I saw during a long period of time was that Chianti bottle where you put the candles in, and it drips all the psychedelic wax along the sides, you know. And I thought, therefore, that I wasn't going to be a drunk like my father, you know, and like those stupid people I grew up around. I wasn't going to drink. I'm trying to think of all the things I drank over. I've got a little list here. Racism, sexism, war, world peace, social injustice, parking tickets, more parking tickets. And then I drank to celebrate a birthday, a good haircut, a new outfit, a new love affair or a new job, or on the flip side, facing another lost year at a birthday, a bad hair day, had some of those in here, or an outfit that didn't fit, or a job, or a relationship. You get the picture. So I drank over lots of people, places, and things that didn't work. They didn't do what I wanted. And interestingly enough, I find that after 12 years and 10 months, I guess, without a drink, there are lots of people, places, and things that still don't do what I want them to do. I drank over family stuff a lot, you know, not just my father. My father died when I was 23, so after he died, of course, instead of being angry at him, I was angry at God because I thought I was being punished, you know, without him. And then I got this really wonderful blessing when I was almost 30. I had a son. But daggone it, you know, as much as he was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened to me, he didn't do everything I wanted him to do. And he didn't seem to be able to meet a lot of my expectations. And the worst part was, you know, like homework, okay? He wouldn't do his homework if I didn't help him, you know, if I didn't sit him down and say, you've got to do this. So I would get mad and I would say, no, I'm not going to help you. And I would go pour myself a couple of drinks, you know. And then I wondered why he wasn't doing well in school. That was a disappointment that I couldn't understand. But what I finally realized was that the thing I was really drinking over wasn't him. It was the fact that I didn't know what my expectations were. I had no idea. I didn't know if they were reasonable. I didn't know if I was meeting any of my expectations. I figured I probably wasn't. But when I drank, none of that stuff mattered. So alcohol was really, really my best friend and my savior. What happened after a long, long time of, you know, drinking to feelings was that I made one of my regular 4 a.m. phone calls. By the way, I gave great phone at 4 a.m. I don't know about any of the rest of you, but, you know, it worked for me. So this particular morning, however, I'd run out of people. I mean, even my drinking buddies wouldn't take my calls at 4 a.m. I don't know. They still don't know what they were missing, but I called a shrink that I'd gone to. I thought it had been about 6 months since I'd seen her. And I was severely, severely depressed. I was suicidal. So I called her and said, you know, I need you to give me something for the depression. And she had me come in and make a long story short. We went through a list of all the stuff that I'd talked about 2.5 years earlier when I'd seen her last. Remember, I said 6 months. And she said, you know, how's your drinking? That was the last question. And I said, it's great. And in fact, it was the only thing working in my life. Every other area of my life, family, health, employment, everything, all relationships, were worse than they had been 2.5 years earlier. And I was pushing 50 at the time. And I thought, this isn't going to work much longer. You know, I got to find a way to get better. So I went to her thinking she was going to give me a pill to get better. And she said, you're an alcoholic. And I said, yeah, I know. And she said, well, I want you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard somebody else say this earlier today. Go to Alcoholics Anonymous and come back in a week and tell me how it's working. And then, if I think I should, I'll write you a prescription. But she said, I want you to know that saying you're an alcoholic is not conversation for me. It's diagnosis. My license depends on it. So I'd appreciate it if you would do this. And I said, okay, fine. So I went and drank myself a couple of bottles of wine to get my nerve up. And I walked into my first AA meeting on August 7th of 1997. And I walked into this room full of complete strangers and God. It was the oddest sensation I've ever had. There was absolutely no question that the God I had been seeking all this time had been sitting there in this meeting, I guess, waiting for me, you know. So I was deeply grateful and I thought this thing was going to work for me. And I started trying to memorize everything you guys said so I could, you know, do whatever it was you did. I thought at first that it was about, you know, if I wanted to be like you, that's not the same as if I want to have what you have, you know? And it took me a while to figure that out. In fact, it took me about 5 years of not drinking to stop being a drunk. I was a seriously dry drunk. I went through about half a dozen sponsors in 5 years. You know, if the sponsor would make me mad, I would stop and find somebody else. I went to jail with 5 years. I walked out in front of my house one day, and there was a guy trying to get by me while I was parking. And he called me a few names, and I said, you know, you really can't say those things to me. And he said the same things, only more. And I wanted to snatch him. I remember thinking, I'm gonna snatch him out of the car and throttle him, you know, like in the cartoons. And then I realized, you know, he's inside a car. I'll probably break all my nails. It'll be a mess, you know. So instead, I walked around and took his windshield wiper and his aerial and bent down and took his driver's license off the front. I still have a scar for that. And then walked in front of him. And I remember thinking that there's a little song that I heard when I was a little kid. Whenever I am afraid, I hold my head up high and whistle a happy tune so no one knows that I'm afraid. And I started whistling and walked into my house and called 911 and told them what had happened. And a couple of days later, a detective came to my house and put cuffs on me and took me into jail. It's a felony to destroy somebody else's property. And when I got into jail, there was nobody else there. And I spent the day on my knees, you know. And I suddenly realized that I'd had all these people helping me, you know, do the right thing. And I still was angry with half the people I knew, starting with myself. I had done some step work, but sort of half-heartedly, you know. I went to tons of meetings. I went to 365 meetings in 365 days and more, you know. So the fellowship was keeping me afloat, but I wasn't doing any work. So, you know, I wasn't practicing these principles in all my affairs, certainly, but probably not in many of them. And then I got serious about this thing because a couple of things weren't working for me. One was that I came in here at almost 50. My mother died when I had 2.5 years. I wanted the house that I'd grown up in, and I wanted to be the lady of the house, finally replacing my mother. I didn't want it to happen like that, but it did. And then I held on to that house so tight that the house started to own me. And one day my sponsor said to me, you know, you might consider that that house isn't where you're supposed to be. And I had never considered that. I'd been in that house for 50 years, back and forth. Every time the bottom fell out of my world, I'd go back home. I thought, how can I not go back home? But she was right. So I sold the house, and then, oh, my gosh, I had money, you know? The real estate market was pretty good when I sold the house. And it took 4 years for me to run through every penny because I didn't want to take a job. When I'd take a job and didn't like it, I'd walk off of it. I didn't want to invest my money. I just wanted to have it and spend it. You know, I bought lots of stuff that was nice, you know, presents for other people. But the point was that I never took care of anything in my life the way you're supposed to take care of your life. You know, a windfall isn't meant to be a joke. And it was a joke for me. I just had fun with it, I thought. I want to get to the topic real quick, practice these principles in our affairs. I lost everything I was supposed to lose, by the way. And the thing I wanted most of all was a person, you know, because I kept the house in part because I knew that if Prince Charming, you know, drove up on his horse, whose name would be, I don't know, Mercedes or something, that he would come and see me in that house and say, whoa, this is just what I've been waiting for. And it didn't happen. And I was kind of pissed. I was like, wait a minute, everybody's got somebody but me. So I spent about a year going to meetings and whining about how lonely I was and how I didn't know why I had to be by myself. And one day I called a friend who said, a friend in the program, and he said, wow, who'd you help today? And I said, huh? And he said, what did you do for somebody today? And I said, that's not what I was talking about. And he said, yeah, I know. That's the problem. So at the time I was afraid because I'm kind of an outgoing loner, and I was afraid to find people to help. I don't know whether I didn't feel worthy or I didn't think they were worthy, but one of those two. So I went to the local shelter, local animal shelter, and I said, I'm going to take care of kittens. because they're not going to do anything, you know. So I'm just going to pet them until they get used to people, and then they can be adopted. And I went in, and I left with an adoption application for a dog. I was not a dog person. I don't know how this happened. But this little creature said, you know, come here, and it worked. It was my mother's birthday. I thought, I don't know, maybe this is... My mother was gone, by the way. I said that, I guess. Anyway, so Lola came along. And, I know this is kind of weird for an AA meeting, but Lola was God. Lola showed me what unconditional love was. Not so that I could have it, but so I could learn to give it. And, I mean, I still love that little doggie. I miss her, but more than that, I love her, and I love the God that helped me realize who I was by sending me something that I couldn't talk back to. People talk about how dogs don't talk back to you. That's bull. You can't talk back to them. And those of you who have cats know that you can't even get their attention. So Lola and I were happy, and all of a sudden, I didn't need a man. I didn't need a best friend. I didn't need to sponsor anybody. I needed my sponsor, but not like I had, you know, because I had Lola. And I'd go to meetings and talk about how wonderful my little dog was, and half of my friends in AA knew my dog. And then one day in May of 2008, Mrs. Tan, yeah, I was walking the dog, and she was having trouble urinating. And I said, there must be some kind of an equivalent of cranberry juice for dogs, so I got to take her to the vet. Well, I took her to the vet. The vet said, no, there's something else going on. And I said, that can't be, because God would not take this dog away from me, because I finally have a life. And make a long story short, it finally ended up with me knowing that I was praying for the wrong thing. I was begging God to not take my dog away from me instead of saying thank you. And instead of thanking God for making a present to me that I had for 5 years, and that, you know, that was the time was up. Well, the same week that Lola went into the hospital, this is where this gets weird, I got a call from this guy who had been a drinking buddy of mine 30 years earlier. We'd been really good friends. And I hadn't seen him for 20 years, didn't know if he was dead or alive. In fact, when he called, I thought somebody that we had worked with 30 years ago must have died, and that's how and why he'd found me. And he said, no, my wife just died, and I wonder if you'd have dinner with me. And I've got to speed this up. He proposed to me less than a month after that dinner. My dog died in the interim. I had to move out of my apartment. Everything that was falling apart kind of got picked up. It was like I was being lifted, you know. I am so happily married right now. It's scary. But you know what? That's still one of my affairs. So I want to real quick do this little... What were my affairs? In all my affairs? Okay, there was a plane ride here that did not work out. I was seated between a linebacker and a center forward, and neither of them would move. And I was in the middle. And it was a five-hour flight to Phoenix from D.C., and then a transfer of planes to get here. Now, anybody who knows the map knows that doesn't make sense. Even the guy at Southwest says, there are only two planes in the entire universe of plane rides that would take you to Phoenix and then fly you back. But it happened. My fellow passengers, one of them had a cold. I kept saying, would you like another tissue? And finally I said, maybe I should be praying for this guy. He's got a cold. He can't possibly be more uncomfortable, less uncomfortable than I am. And then all of a sudden he stopped sniffling. It was cool. It was very cool. This marriage thing, you know, in sickness and in health, and for richer and for poorer. I hate that part. The poorer part, I hate it. But it's part of it. It's part of my affairs that I have to work on. I want to read something real quick, though, because I don't want this. I don't have anything left to say except that I'm terribly, terribly grateful for all of you and, you know, and for being sober today. But I want to. I tried to figure out, what am I doing here? How did I get this? I have no idea who put my name in. Knowing the people I know, whoever it was, will never tell me, so I'll never know. But I got an email that said show up, and I showed up, and I don't know how it happened except for two things. One is that if you're in here and you have less than 12 years, the last thing you want to hear is another person with 40 years. So I figure what they did was they balanced this thing out with people who didn't have as much time, because that's what would have kept me coming back. So that's a wonderful thing. But more importantly, I had to stop worrying about why and why I was here and worry about what the job was, okay? And the job is in the book. It's in the literature. The first thing is in my favorite, As Bill Sees It. And this is from a letter from Bill Wilson in 1959. He says, sooner or later, most of us are presented with other obligations to family, friends, and country. As you will remember, the 12th step also refers to practicing these principles in all our affairs. Therefore, I think your choice of whether to take a particular 12-step job is to be found in your own conscience. No one else can tell you for certain what you ought to do at a particular time. I just know that you are expected at some point to do more than carry the message of AA to other alcoholics. This is the ultimate demonstration towards which 12-step work is the first but not the final step. That was the first piece. And then in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 102, in working with others, it says your job is now to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. And then the second reading from the Big Book in A Vision for You is on page 161. It says, but life among Alcoholics Anonymous is more than attending gatherings and visiting hospitals. Cleaning up old scrapes, helping to settle family differences, explaining the disinherited son to his irate parents, lending money and securing jobs for each other when justified. These are everyday occurrences. So it talks about us doing stuff, but again, they're still talking about with alcoholics. But then in the 12 and 12, and this is, I'm going to close with this, it says service gladly rendered, step 12. Service gladly rendered, obligation squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help. The knowledge that at home or in the work outside, in the world outside, we are partners in a common effort. The well understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. The proof that love freely given surely brings a full return. The certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons. The surety that we need no longer be square pegs in round holes, but can fit and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living, for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. I feel like I fit at last, and for me, knowing that and really sincerely thanking God for that instead of thinking that I did it is how I start practicing these principles in all my affairs. The second thing I do is try to show up when asked, no matter what the terms are and no matter who asks me. And then finally, I just want to say that the only thing I can think of that was scarier for me than seeing 6,600 people was seeing 660. But I love you guys. I love you. So thank you so much for coming and keep coming back.
Thank you, Lee. That was wonderful. I want to just share one short story. Sometimes the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous can come up and bite me when I don't have any idea that they're going to. And in 2001, my dearest friend, darling husband, wonderful lover, had a heart attack while he was attending the General Service Conference on the last day of the conference. A really major heart attack, and I was in California and he was in New York. And they called me up and said, I think you better come. You might not make it, because he might not make it. And so I hung up the phone and I thought, now what am I supposed to be thinking? What am I supposed to be feeling when my husband's just had a heart attack? Which said a lot about the way I lived my life a lot before I got sober, because so much of my life was based on a script. You know, I had to look back and see what movie or book would give me a clue about how to feel about things. But this was a new thing for me, and I wasn't feeling much of anything. I guess I was kind of in shock. But then my first thought, my first feeling was, I am so grateful that we have had 20 years of sobriety together and that we are so much in love. And if he dies, I'm going to be sad and so on, but I but I felt this enormous gratitude, and I thought, well, that is very peculiar. What an amazing gift this is that Alcoholics has given me, that that I don't immediately go into how bad I feel. This isn't even my experience. This is his experience. What a concept. The idea that I could amazingly realize that it wasn't my tragedy, but his. And he did obviously recover. He's right there. And we've had a lot of years since his quadruple bypass surgery. But I'm more in love with him now than I ever have been. But it's just amazing the gifts and of this program. They continue to absolutely astound me. And to finish our panel today, I'd like to introduce Joe give us our final talk. And then I guess we'll have some time off and we'll go over and meet up at our birthday party at the Alidome.
Joe?
My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. Sweet. There goes my water. It's a good thing I have some principles. Might have said something really nasty there. I don't know if Marty's here, but our delegate from Area 79, but I put my name in to serve coffee in the hospitality suite, and... I don't know what happened there, Marty, but my home group is the Cowichan Station Discussion Group, which I believe there are some members here tonight, somewhere. They're very quiet. It's a quiet group. And I live on Vancouver Island, British Columbia, on the west coast of Canada. I'm not going to go into my drinking history. I think you can pretty much assume that I drank too much. I can say that I started out drinking to have fun, and at the end of my drinking, I was obsessed with drinking. I'll say that much about my drinking. On August 9th, 1988, my wife, Christy, had to quit drinking to save her life. She was in the hospital, and the doctors had told her if she didn't quit drinking, she would die. And her father had died when she was 15 years old of the very same thing that she was in the hospital for. So she took that pretty seriously, and she made a decision to quit drinking. I was shocked, to say the least, that my wife was going to quit drinking because we drank a lot together. Or at least we drank a lot at the same time, anyway. We didn't often drink together. She was an at-home drinker. I was a bar drinker, and we made that work. But I took as an opportunity, after the shock wore off, that, possibly that maybe I could just start drinking normally now. That maybe I could change the way I drank, and I could drink the way I wanted to, 20 years prior. I wanted to just drink to have fun, lubricate myself socially, just be one of the boys. I'd considered my wife a pretty hopeless alcoholic for a while, but I thought of myself as more of a heavy drinker with a lot of bad luck. I had no idea how obsessed I was. So from August 9th, 1988, I went out on my quest to be a social drinker. And I tell you, that was a real eye-opener. To any of you that have tried that, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. I had no idea, how hooked I was on booze, how much I thought about booze. Yeah. I could not drink for a couple of days, but I could not think about drinking for a couple of days. It was just one fiasco after another. One failure, one broken promise after the other. So on December 15th, 1988, which was 4 months later approximately, I made a decision that I couldn't drink anymore either. At that time, my father had been sober for about 9 years, and my best friend had been sober for about 5 years, both in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they both offered their services to my wife and I when we quit drinking. And we told them that we didn't need it, you know. We were going to do this on our own will. And my wife had already quit drinking for 4 months on her own will. And I saw how much better she was looking. I just assumed I could do the same, you know. I've always been a bit of a self-willed person. And, you know, I'm self-employed. I always thought I was unemployable. That was the reason I was self-employed. You know, I don't like other people telling me what to do, when to do, how to do it. And that got me into a lot of trouble. We quit drinking. We had a sober Christmas, a shaky Christmas, apple juice for toasting on Christmas dinner. It was pretty good, you know. We felt better, you know. My shaking stopped, you know. My eyes cleared. I started feeling a lot healthier. And as Brian said earlier, you know, after about a month, I thought I was, you know, obviously I didn't have that big a problem. I was correct. I was just a heavy drinker with a lot of bad luck. And I told my wife I was going to go on a curling bonspiel. That's something we do in Canada. Involves ice. That I'd be drinking for the weekend, but I'd quit as soon as I got back. And she told me she didn't think this was a very good idea. And she was pretty sure that it was not a good idea. And, you know, I had to agree. I went on the bond spiel. I didn't drink. It was actually a real eye-opener when I saw how many other people were drinking and the fools they were making to themselves, and being sober in that environment wasn't safe for me. After about 10 months of sobriety, still not gone to a meeting, my brother-in-law, my wife's brother, called us and asked for help. He knew we weren't drinking, and he asked if he could come and if we could help him. And we said, yeah, you can come and stay with us. You got to quit drinking. And we called in my best friend, who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, to help my brother-in-law, because he, of course, was far sicker than we were, and he needed help. My best friend took him to a couple of meetings, and he stayed sober for a couple of weeks and was living with us, and that was working out pretty fine. And one week, my friend couldn't make it for some reason or the other, you know, and my brother-in-law didn't look like he was going to be heading out the door that night. It was meeting night, and I didn't think he was going to be going anywhere, and I was pretty concerned about that he would have a slip and if he stopped going to meetings. So I decided to go to the meeting with him. And you know what happened. It's a trap. You know, I went to the meeting with Lou. And, you know, I sat down near the stove. There was lots of empty chairs there. Found out later during the meeting why there was a lot of empty chairs by the stove. There's a wood stove. And about halfway through the meeting, it's about 110 there. They know that's where the newcomers sit, right? They don't know not to sit that close to the stove. Yeah. So they asked at the beginning of the meeting, is there anybody here? It's the first meeting. Of course, I stick up my hand. I'm thinking, you know, they probably want to know how I stayed sober for 10 months on my own will and maybe have some questions for me. And I could help them out. That wasn't it. they started telling me their stories. And I'm telling you, I guess it was just whatever. It was just luck of the draw. The first couple of guys that were telling me stories, they were real low-bottom drunks. I mean, these guys were sleeping in dumpsters and waking up every 2 hours to have a drink. And, you know, I mean, these were sad cases. And I thought, man, I'm in the wrong place. You know, this is, I can see these guys had a problem with alcohol real bad. And I'm just not relating to this stuff at all. You know, and you got nowhere to look. You're in your first meeting. You know, you can't look at any of the people. They're all looking at you. You start looking around, you know. I looked on the wall and I saw this old tattered pull-down blind and it had the 12 steps written on it. And I thought, fine, I'll read these and see what this is about. You know, these are these 12 steps. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our drinking had become unmanageable. You know, that's what I saw. For a long time I saw that. Step two, you know, came to believe. And I was like, okay, what's this? You know, I could see there was something coming here, you know. I figured it was some sort of trap, you know, some sort of church thing, you know, some sort of religion, you know. I quickly switched into what my wife and I call man-looking or man-scanning. It's a unique ability that I think all men have, that we can look over things and we can just see things and we can pick out key words or thoughts. We don't need to take the bother of reading everything, you know, because we can figure it out pretty much on our own, right? And it takes a fraction of the time. So I looked over the steps, and I just saw one, you know, drinking unmanageable. Two, God. Three, God. Four, secrets. Five, God. Six, God. Seven, God. Eight, I'm sorry. Nine, I'm sorry. Ten, I'm sorry. 11, God. And 12, carry the message. And this is what I saw. I saw a lot of God. I saw nothing but God. And I thought, how can I get this? I have no God. You know? I think that man developed out of a single cell, out of the sea or something, you know, I don't know. I had a contempt for religion. And I didn't think I had a belief for God. Later in that meeting, I heard a couple of stories that I could relate to. And that kept me coming back. You know, I saw a couple of guys in that meeting that I used to drink with at the bar. And that kept me coming back. But I wasn't going to do those steps. I felt those were pretty serious tactics for pretty sick guys, you know. And the guys that were spoke first, I guess, they needed those things. And, you know, I was well enough, I didn't need them. 2.5 years, well, about 1.5 years passed. So I had about 2.5 years of sobriety. And I think Lee mentioned something about 2.5 years of sobriety, too. And I had 2.5 years of sobriety on my will. That's it, on my will. And my wife and I were still enabling each other to stay sober, you know. And she was staying sober on her will, and I was staying sober on mine. But by 2.5 years of sobriety, we were fighting a lot. You know, we weren't getting along very well anymore. I wasn't getting along with my customers. I thought of them as the enemy, you know. I didn't think of them as someone who has provided me an opportunity to earn a living to support my family. I thought of them as a foe, you know. And that's what I walked into their houses every day with, an attitude of, you're going to get me, I have to get you first. I didn't treat, I had people working for me, I didn't treat them very well. I was very self-centered and self-willed and angry. I thought it was an anger problem. I think right now we've finally figured out it's a fear problem, but it comes out as anger, right? And my family, they weren't talking to me much either. My father had told me that they'd moved away, and they'd moved closer to be near us. And they'd moved about 30 miles away. And 5 weeks later, they moved away and didn't tell us where they moved. Yeah. That was my father. And by that time, he'd had about 13 years of sobriety. I wasn't happy. You know, I knew I needed to do something. Right? What could I do? What could I do? I had to do the steps. Right? By then, I'd read them right through. You know, I hadn't just man-scanned them. I'd read the whole thing. I had a big book. I decided I had to do the steps. Well, the first step is, all right, I got the drinking was unmanageable. I think when I first did my first steps, I still was thinking it was drinking. But the second step, okay, now this is the kicker. What do I do now? It's God. You know, and I said, Joe, who do you talk to when you need help? Right? I talk to somebody, you know, not out loud. In my mind, I talk and I ask for help. Right? Help me get through this. Help me today. Please don't let that person, you know, get hurt, whatever. I thought, maybe that's my God. I'm going to call that my God. Right? I've got a God. Right? I've got a God. Finally. I've got a God that I can believe in. I can't put a picture to it. I can't explain it to you other than what I just said. But it's a God. So with that God, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to that God. And I remember the feeling I got when I made that decision. I mean, I was in deep doo-doo. I was not well-liked, and I wasn't very happy, and I wasn't very happy about not being very happy, and I certainly wasn't very happy about not being liked. I want to be liked, you know, they all do. And I. But I tell you, I was happy when I figured out that I had a God that I could use in that program. A God that would get me through all those steps. Right? I did a fourth step. Took me a while. Oh my God, 2 minutes. I did a fourth step. Took me a while. I went to a sponsor. I got a real sponsor, my friend. He had 8 years of sobriety by now. Did a fifth step with him. Six and seven. I did by a fire that night. And my eighth and ninth, I got to go do some amends. I patched it up with my father. 10, I believe, is 4 through 9, you know. And I think the most important thing about 4 through 9, or 10, is that I find my part in my problems. I have a note on my mirror that I look into every day when I shave that says, if you think you've got a problem, you're looking at it. I have to own my part in my problems. That in itself has changed me. 11 is ask for help in the morning and give thanks at night. 12, carry the message to the best of my ability. I'm involved in service work. I love service work. What I get back is far more than what I put out. I'm glad Bill said, tried to practice these principles in all our affairs. He always gave us a way out, you know, so we didn't feel trapped. But we know we have to practice these principles in all our affairs. So whenever I don't practice these principles in all my affairs, you get a feedback right away, right? When I feel that angst in my stomach, I know that there's a problem, that I'm not doing something right, that I have to make a change. I never had that before, and thanks to this program, I have it now. We all have it. My father passed away in 2004, and I got a 25-year medallion made up for him. And I never got a chance to give it to him. But I carry it with me all the time. I hope I never lose it, but if I do, it doesn't matter. I'll just get another one. He never went to an international conference, but he's with me here today. Thanks. I love my father. When he passed away, we were good friends. If I could introduce him to you, I would ask you to say hello to him, like another alcoholic. I'll have to speak for him. My name is Joe Sr., and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.